Good morning. I'm Shelley Ryan, sitting in for Larry Mueller for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm actually the host of the Wisconsin Gardener on Wisconsin Public Television, so if you hear me saying television instead of radio, just bear with me. My guest is Neil DeBole, and he is one of the owners and founders, if I remember correctly, of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. And Neil and I go way back, so this should be a very fun time. We're going to be talking about prairie plants, how to attract butterflies to your yard. We can talk about getting weeds out of the prairie, and one of my favorite topics, burning the prairie. So we will have lots of time to answer your questions, and if you'd like to call in, it's 1-800-642-1234. That's toll-free from anywhere you are listening. And if you're in Madison, please use 263-1890. And don't forget, you can also send your question via email to talk@wpr.org. So, Neil, it's so nice to see you.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, this is kind of scary. We've got two crazy redheads in one small room, so we'll have to behave today.
I don't know how we'll do it, but we'll manage somehow.
Well, we have calls already, but let's talk a little bit about you've been part of Prairie Nurseries for how long now?
25 years now.
Wow, it has been that long.
Yep.
And we've known each other probably for about 15. So
yep.
We just dated ourselves, Neil. Well, one of the things that, in fact, you influenced me many years ago before you even knew me personally. One of the first things I planted in my yard was a small prairie. And I found it very entertaining that the comments from the neighbors back then was, are you the one putting in the wildflowers? And it seems like, I think, thanks to a lot to your influence, we've come a long way in the legitimacy of prairie gardens.
Well, I think it's an evolution that's happened over time. And as more and more people have begun to appreciate our native plants and the beauty of the plants, the low maintenance, the hardiness, the fact you don't have to use all these fertilizers and herbicides to maintain them, it just makes a lot of sense. And they weren't accepted as garden plants.
No.
25 years ago. I mean, 25 years ago, I couldn't give this stuff away.
Right.
Okay. Now it's like, hey, this is a great thing because people have realized these are wonderful plants. Just because grandma didn't plant them doesn't mean they aren't excellent plants for your garden or for your landscape.
Well, and if you think of it, probably the reason grandma didn't is they were considered the weeds encroaching on their controlled environment. Well, these were here before we were.
Well, the first thing we had to do was kill all the native plants so we could plant our plants,
right.
i.e. plants from Europe.
Right.
And so they were the bad guys to start with, and they were indiscriminately just basically almost eliminated.
Even though they are the plants that gave us the great soil that then made it a wonderful place to farm.
Precisely. So. And we owe the prairie a tremendous debt because it built these wonderful
right.
soils that we've been essentially mining agriculturally for years and have provided our corn, beans, wheat, et cetera, which
exactly.
has been a great strength of the country.
Well, and I'm hoping sometime today, like I said, we'll have time to talk about my favorite topic, burning. We introduced my 10-year-old kid to our burn in our prairie last year, and it was great fun.
Excellent.
So we have a number of calls on the line, people from all over Wisconsin with questions for you. So I'm going to attempt to hit the first one and see what we can come up with. This should be Jack in Eagle River.
Yes,
Jack, are you there?
Yes, sure am.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
It looks like you have a question about prairie plants and drought. Go
yes,
ahead, please.
We've been suffering from drought up here all summer. And we have a prairie plant garden that runs about 125 feet along the road in front of our house. And people that come by are always so complimentary. They see the beauty of these plants. And nobody has yet said, what are you doing with the wildflowers, by the way? But anyway, we've been to the prairie nursery every chance we get, and we picked up stuff there. But my question is, in view of the drought, now this is a garden that was first started maybe 4 years ago, and each section has you know been done each year, so that the newest would be maybe year at the least. So here we are wondering how much watering does prairie plants need versus your regular run of the mill plants.
Well, it depends on what stage the plants are at, Jack. For the plants that you just put in this year, obviously, like any new transplant, you need to, if it's dry, you need to water them for the first few months while they get established. Once these prairie plants become established and have good, firm root systems, many of their roots can go down 4, 5, 6, 10 feet and deeper. So during drought, they tend to hold up pretty well. Now, a big question for you is how have your plants held up this year?
I have to say, so far, so good. And we have some new ones that we've been paying more attention to. So that they have held up well. I guess you're right. there's only one way to find out, I guess, is to see how they're doing.
Yeah, I very seldom water my prairie. I was tempted this year when it was so dry in July for us in central Wisconsin, and I resisted. And it suffered, but, you know, as soon as the rains came in August, it perked right back up. The flowers came back. The grasses look beautiful. So they are really tough plants, and what you'll see is during periods of drought, they will often go into dormancy or suspended animation, and some will just quit for the year and come back the next year because the vast majority of them are perennials, or a lot of them will just wait it out, and when the rains come, they come back. So, and a lot of people I've spoken to said their traditional plants in their gardens are just fried, but the prairie plants just keep going.
Right. That's the beauty of them. Does that answer your question, Jack?
Yes, it does. And I had one other quickie, if
okay,
you will.
Okay, sure.
Almost all the plants are various shades of purple or yellow and gold, yellow or gold. And I'm curious, how many other color varieties could we get? For instance, would there be reds and whites available? So far, we haven't been able to find them.
There are a wide variety of white flowers available. The reds are very uncommon in our native prairie plants. There's only a couple of species with red flowers, but there are a wide variety of whites, and the whites tend to be predominant in the spring, and then in the fall, the white asters. There's a number of white flowered asters, but in the spring you have plants like white false indigo, the smooth penstemon, and the smooth penstemon combines very nicely with the spiderworts, which are blue. So there's a number of varieties of plants that you could plant for spring, and then there's the wild quinine, which is a summer blooming plant, which is also excellent and very drought tolerant.
I've got that in my prairie, and it's absolutely gorgeous, too. It's one of the taller plants, so it really stands out.
And it holds up extremely well under all kinds of difficult conditions.
It's also a very nice dried flower.
It is, isn't it? And it holds its color so well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Does that help, Jack?
Thank you, and may you prosper.
Oh, thank you. Enjoy the day, and I hope you'll keep listening. All right. It looks like we have next is Caitlin from Milwaukee. And the question, Caitlin, is about weeding a garden and weed killer?
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is not necessarily about prairie plants, but I was wondering, I have four garden beds, and they're all full of weeds, and I'm just curious.
I can relate.
Yeah, and I'm curious if I weed them now, you know, before winter comes and put weed killer, will that help, or is it better to just wait till next spring to weed them?
Okay. That depends upon what kind of weeds you have. Do you know what the weeds are, Caitlin?
No, but there's a multitude of different kinds.
You have a blessing of weeds, a wide variety.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, basically we divide weeds into three categories, annuals, biennials, and perennials. And if you have weeds, especially annuals, that have seeds on them now, it would behoove you to remove them very carefully so the seeds don't shatter and fall back into your planting beds. And just pull them up. They typically pull up easily because they don't have deep root systems. And remove them from the area and just so they don't reseed in the area. Same with biennials. Some of the biennials you have are like burdock, the sweet clovers. There's quite a variety. And you want to get those out as well. But if you have perennials, those are more difficult because they have typically deeper root systems, and in some cases they have rhizomatous root systems, meaning creeping, running roots like quackgrass, which you can pull that out till the cows come home, but good luck getting the last root. It's very, very difficult. So you have to determine what kind of weeds you have as far as how you're going to handle them. But anything that has seeds on it, you would get it out immediately. And as far as weed killer, there's a variety of different weed killers. When you talk herbicides, you have contact herbicides like Roundup, which basically kills almost everything upon contact on green foliage.
So unfortunately, you've got to be careful because that includes the plants that are that you want to keep.
Yes, you want to be super careful because it's a pretty broad spectrum plant killer. And then there's pre-emergence, which many people will use in their garden beds in the spring, which prevent the germination of weed seeds. These are pre-emergence, like preen, which is commonly available at garden centers, which basically stops the germination of weed seeds. If you're growing anything from seed, though, in that area, you want to make sure you don't use that because then it will hamper the growth of those plants as well. So you want to tailor your herbicide application based upon what you're killing and the appropriate time of year to do it and be very, very careful and read the directions.
And more is not always better. I think that's one of our biggest mistakes. Well, I've got a lot of bad weeds. We'll use some more killer. Gee, I don't have any perennials left. So really read the instruction. And what I've also found is you can pull out even the perennial weeds now, and it weakens them a little bit so that next spring when you're working on them again, they're going to fight you a little less harder.
Yep, absolutely. The more root you can remove, the better. Yeah.
That answer your question, Caitlin?
Yes. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. All right. Boy, we've got some more calls. This is another fun one, Neil. make sure I hit the right button here. This is David from Green Bay, and he wants to get rid of Canadian goldenrod.
Yeah, so along the same lines as what you were just speaking about, these are rhizomatous plants, and if I was, I did the glove of death with Roundup this spring, but it only knocked them down, and now I do have some pretty big plants with blooms and everything now. My question would be, should I cut off the blooms and then do the glove again? Should I pull them out, as you just alluded to, Shelley, and then wait until next spring to do the Roundup application yet again? What is the best way to get rid of this stuff?
Okay, you have basically quackgrass with a flower, Canada goldenrod. And this is a native plant. And this is an interesting case here. All native plants aren't necessarily good. Okay, there's a couple bad guys out there. And Canada goldenrod is one of the most aggressive weeds that we find that can get into our prairies. And that's because the seeds float on the wind and get into prairies. It's one of the absolute worst weeds we run into. How much area do you have with this, David?
You know, it's not that big.
10
stalks?
I don't
know, 1,000. No, probably 1,000. It's in the city limits of Green Bay. I can't burn the darn thing either. But it's pretty small. It's only about, 30 feet wide and maybe 70 feet long. I don't know.
So you have 100 stalks, 1,000 stalks?
Oh, there's several clumps of plants. I don't know.
Okay.
It's probably, a couple hundred stalks.
Okay. Are the leaves still green, or have they started to turn
yeah.
brown? Okay, what you can do, this is a very good time to go in with that glove of death method, which is where you put heavy-duty plastic gloves, herbicide gloves, rubber gloves on both hands, and then put an absorbent cotton glove on one hand, and then you very carefully apply herbicide. I use a little, one of those little plant spritzer bottles, put a big crossbones on it and say Roundup, and then put that on stream, not mist, but on stream, so it doesn't aerate on aerosols that can get on your adjacent plants. And then saturate that glove just to the point before it drips, and then you stroke the plant from basically as far down to the base as you can along the leaves. And this is a good time to do it because in fall, plants are translocating down into their roots, and it's actually more effective than doing it in the spring, because in the spring, the energy in the plant is coming up out of the ground, so it's not taking the herbicide down into the roots as much as it does in the fall. So I would suggest you go out with that glove this weekend and hit those guys and see if you don't get a much better kill than in the spring.
Would you recommend cutting the blooms off first just so that no seeds are created that are going to seed plants elsewhere?
Are they still in bloom?
Yes.
Okay, if you apply the herbicide this weekend, those blooms will probably not progress to seed, but just in case, it wouldn't hurt to take them off. Because some plants can continue to form seed even after they've been pulled or dead.
So you've got a busy weekend, David. Does that help?
Well, yes, but one more question. What about repopulating the area with some plants? Do you recommend then buying some maybe started prairie plants and then transplanting them next spring in those areas?
That's an excellent way to do it, but before you put your plants in, make sure that the goldenrod is dead so it doesn't come back.
Okay, David, we're going to take a quick break, so I hope that helped you, and we'll come back to more calls in just a quick sec. We are talking about prairies with Neil DeBole, and we invite you to join in with your own questions. Call 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 if you're in the Madison area. I'm Shelley Ryan, in for Larry Mueller, and this is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking questions about prairies with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery. And I should mention, if you don't get a chance to get to us today, you can reach Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin by calling their phone number, which is 1-800-476-9453, or you can go online to prairienursery.com. And Neil is usually available there because even before he knew me, I was bothering the poor man. So we're going to go on with some more questions. And this is my favorite topic coming up, Neil. These are the prairie burns. I think I'm a closet pyromaniac in my secret life. So let's see what Prudence from Whitewater has to say. Go ahead, Prudence.
Thank you for taking my call. I live in Whitewater, Wisconsin, and we at our condominium project are in the midst of establishing a prairie that borders a municipal wetland beautiful area, but somewhat weedy, and our lawn. We're doing quite well, but our major, major nemesis has been the weed problem, and we are working with a prairie manager who's been helping us with this. But my question is in regard to a burn. We had a burn this spring which did not work. It just didn't take off all the way down, which I know sometimes happens. I've had two divergent points of view on what is the best time to do a prairie burn in regard to window of opportunity and in regard to effectiveness in controlling the noxious weeds and allowing the flowers and grasses to come. A spring or a fall burn. Do you have an opinion on this? Do you have any data on this that could help us make a decision? Or is it something that is pretty much dictated by weather?
Well, fire is a tool, and it depends on what your goals are as far as how you will apply this tool. For instance, if you have a dry prairie, which it doesn't sound like you do, I assume this is more of a mesic prairie, which has medium-type soils like loam or clay, is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. In a dry prairie, you have a lot of flowers that come up early, like prairie smoke and pasque flower and violets, and those are typically better burned in the fall because you don't want to burn in the spring when those flowers are coming up early and could be damaged. However, most people don't have dry prairies. Most people have mesic prairies or wet mesic prairies on regular, normal soils. And as a result, what happens often in those cases is you get invasion by cool season weeds and grasses like quackgrass, bromegrass. In the prairie, bluegrass is a weed. In fact, it's a pretty serious weed, as well as clover, red clover, white clover. These are all cool season non-native grasses and plants that can become established and give you a lot of competition because most of your prairie plants are warm season and will not come up until later, usually towards the end of April, early May. So they'll be dormant under the soil while these cool season non-native plants get a jump up to 4 weeks head start. So if that's your problem where you have a lot of cool season weeds, we typically will burn the prairie in late spring, usually around late April, even early May, depending on the weather and your soil type and your location. In southern Wisconsin, it'll be earlier, and in northern Wisconsin, it'll be later. The best way to tell when to burn a prairie for good control of cool season weeds is when the buds of the sugar maple tree are just breaking. And this is usually about the time you're going to mow the lawn for the second time, depending on how crazy you are about mowing your lawn. But this is well after things have greened up. And this is a mistake that most people make is they burn their prairie too early. As soon as it looks like spring, they go out there and they burn it. And all it does is grow more quackgrass. Because what you want to do is you want to let these cool season grasses and weeds emerge from the soil, get 4, 5, 6 inches tall, and then burn. That will do damage to those plants. And secondly, after you burn, the soil turns black when the sun shines on that black soil. The temperature of the soil goes up very rapidly. In fact, some studies I did showed that the soil after burning rose 18 degrees Fahrenheit in 4 days, 4 sunny days, in a burned plot versus an unburned plot. So it changes the whole temperature regime of the soil, which favors the warm season prairie plants. Now, you want to be careful. You don't want to burn every year, because if you do, you're going to push the equilibrium of your prairie towards all warm season plants, like prairie grasses, like Indian grass, big blue stem, little blue stem, etc., and many of the latter season flowers. So we normally will burn every other year. Now, people argue about this, but if you let it go more than a couple of years, you run the risk of invasion by woody plants like trees and shrubs, which naturally will dominate without burning or mowing. If you are in a situation where you can't burn, you can substitute mowing, where you use the same timing, late April usually, mow right down to the ground, and then, if possible, rake everything off to expose the soil so it warms up, again, heating up the soil to favor the predominantly warm season prairie plants. Okay. However, be careful. Burning is a pretty magic bullet, but it's not a complete magic bullet. It will not do anything against Canada goldenrod, which we spoke about earlier, and it won't do anything against Canada thistle. So there's a couple weeds, especially these perennial rhizomatous weeds, that it doesn't really control very well. But it will do a wonder against a tremendous variety of weeds, especially cool season weeds, with this proper timing.
Thanks for that call, Prudence. I hope that answered. That was an excellent explanation. It tells me we've been timing our burn a little bit oddly, too. But usually it seems like in my yard, if I can get the family to do it, it's time to do it.
Well, so sometimes it's just when the convenience.
Strike when the iron's hot.
Yes, but timing is really, really important right. As far as controlling those problem weeds. Really important.
Well, and in ours, we have sumac that creep in. We're right on the edge of the Military Ridge bike trail, and that's not burned. So you get the woody plants sneaking in.
Yep.
So I put my husband in charge of that. It's easier that way. We have another call. This is from Waukesha, and this is Susan, and she has a question about preparation for prairie seeds. That's always a fun topic, too. Let's see if I remember from learning from you, Neil. Cold stratification, do I have it?
Are you talking about preparation of seed or preparation of the seed bed?
Oh, actually, she's saying seeds. Is that okay, right, Susan?
Well, actually, a friend of ours gave us a whole bunch of seeds, grasses and prairie plants this summer, and we wanted to prepare an area to plant them. And so we have an area on a hillside that's just, you know, wild, whatever's been growing there. And we don't know if we should mow it first and then spray it with Roundup, and if you can just do one application of Roundup, or if you need to do multiple applications, and if we can just throw the seeds on, or if we do have to, you know, stratify them or whatever. So some of those questions.
Okay. Shelley, how long do we have? We have a half an hour for this?
No, there's other callers. We got to be nice.
This is the most technical and most variable aspect of prairie restoration is site preparation. And it's
right, totally
dependent on your situation. In your situation, you have obviously probably lots of established perennial weeds, which will definitely be a challenge to get rid of. And usually when we have a situation like that, we will spend between 1 to 2 years killing the weeds to make sure they're dead before we put down any seeds.
And boy, I wish I'd done that the first time.
It's so important. And I can assure you this, if you just go out there and spray it once with Roundup and put your seeds down, you're going to run some big risks, because typically one application of Roundup will only kill a certain percentage of the weeds. Different weeds are actively growing at different times of the year, and hence are subjected to the herbicide, or will only be killed by the herbicide at certain times of the year. So you have to be really careful. And then even after you kill all the perennials, if it's an area that's been wild and weedy for years, you've got all those seeds hiding in the soil. It's like Pandora's box, and you kill all the weeds and open it up, and boom, wow, where did all those weeds come from? So we oftentimes will take it 2 full years and just keep killing everything before we plant. Now, how do you kill? You have a variety of different ways to do this. One is you can use old, good old Roundup and spray it and spray it and spray it, but a lot of people don't want to use herbicides. So in smaller areas, you can use smothering, where you put down black plastic, or maybe get some old silo plastic, or on a small area you can put down cardboard or newspaper. And of course, the year that whenever I go to put newspaper down, it's always the windiest day of the year, so you know, it never fails. But there are many different ways that you can prepare the area. If it's a lawn, you can spray it typically once if it doesn't have any weeds, and then plant right into that. Or if you wish, you can smother that lawn for about 2 to 3 months and kill everything. And by scattering the seed into the dead lawn in the fall, the seed will work its way down into the ground over the winter and come up next spring.
And what's nice about that is you're actually letting the winter do the cold stratification for you instead of you having to do it in the refrigerator.
Precisely. And fall plantings are excellent, especially if you are really wanting a good display of flowers, because the flower seeds typically will do better with a fall seeding because of those dormancy breaking requirements that they have sitting in the cold soil over the winter. However, your warm season prairie grasses will do not as well with a fall seeding, because there just seems to be some loss of seed, or it just doesn't germinate as well. So if your goal is the warm season prairie grasses, you want to plant those in the spring and early summer, May and June. But if your goal is more flowers and grasses, then you're probably better off planting in the fall. That said, you can still get excellent results with a prairie by planting it either spring or fall. The only thing is, if your goal is primarily warm season grasses, those should be planted in the spring.
Does that help, Susan?
Well, if we were going to wait and, you know, spend a year or two preparing the site, what could we do with the seeds in the meantime?
Excellent question.
Very good, yeah.
Put that seed in 2 Ziploc bags or garbage bags, depending on the quantity of the seed, and put it in the refrigerator. And you can keep some seeds up to 5 years. Now, some have shorter viability. Some only keep 1 to 2 years.
Lettuce doesn't last from season to season. No. But I've got bean seeds that have lasted for 7 years.
Yep. And there's corn seeds that lasted in the pyramids for, 4,000 years. Of course,
yeah.
They didn't have refrigerators. But
yeah, but they did. So they knew how to keep it cool and dry is
exactly.
The trick.
And that's the trick, exactly. The enemies of seed are heat and moisture. So make sure it's in double plastic bags and put it in the refrigerator. And that will keep most of those seeds viable for a couple of years. Okay, but take your time on site preparation. And if you want more information on it, you can go to our website. That's www.prairienursery.com. And also you can ask for a catalog, and we have all sorts of information on site preparation in our catalog also.
Does that help, Susan?
Yeah, well, that's great. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. You know, one thing we haven't talked about yet is some of the plants in a prairie that are just dynamite for attracting butterflies and birds. Rattle off a few off the top of your head, Neil.
Well, of course, the unsurpassed is butterfly weed.
Yes.
Which, you know, notice how people that name these, they weren't into marketing.
Yeah, right. But weed is the wrong word for this.
Oh, another excellent butterfly plant, Joe Pie weed.
See, weed again. But yep. Well, and you can find these, you know, in a lot of native spots, too, and they're just gorgeous,
phenomenal,
too.
Phenomenal. And related to the butterfly weed is the red milkweed or marsh milkweed, which is a very important host plant for the monarch butterfly larva.
Which are a little bit at risk, so that would be something worth planting.
Absolutely. So you want it, when you're gardening for butterflies, you want to create food for every stage of the butterfly, from egg to larva to adult, chrysalis, the whole nine yards. And so you can have a lot of different nectar plants, like the blazing stars. These are fabulous. The genus Liatris and Echinacea, your
purple
coneflowers.
That's the ones I'm thinking of, yeah.
Phenomenal. Just great. And there's so many others. And we have like a butterfly mix.
That's right, yeah.
Which is
has everything in it that
designed.
You need.
Yep. And you want to make sure and have those host plants for the larva as much as possible. And there are many butterflies that utilize tree leaves and shrub leaves. So a combination of prairie mixed with native shrubs and native trees gives you the optimal habitat for a wide variety of butterflies.
Well, and not everyone has to have, like you're saying, just a prairie. You can incorporate some of these plants into a regular perennial garden or along the side of the house, anywhere, and you're providing habitat.
Absolutely.
If you plant it, they will come.
It's true. And a friend of mine in Minneapolis planted a garden in his lot in downtown Minneapolis. And he planted all these different native prairie plants, and he got butterflies and birds to come in there like you would not believe. And he's surrounded by factories and apartment buildings,
yeah.
But he had this little oasis, and it was amazing, his list. He kept a list of all the birds and butterflies. It was phenomenal.
Well, and for me this time of year, watching the goldfinches, you know, eating off of some of the, like my compass plant and things like that, they're having a party out there.
Yeah, they have a big party in our nursery, too. A very expensive little party.
Yeah, really. You kind of want to keep those seeds. Well, we have some more calls coming in, Neil. This one is... Let me get the right number. This is Josh in Boscobel. And Josh, it sounds like you have a plant identification question.
Yeah, and I have a comment, too, about burning.
Okay.
Maybe caution people on that can be very dangerous if you don't do it correctly. So make sure you're completely prepared. I'm a volunteer firefighter, and some of the largest grass fires I've ever seen have been through prairies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and actually there's a very good book, I don't know if it's still out, that I picked up from the Arboretum that actually talks a beginner through all of the safe steps to a prairie burn. And I think it included instructions to call the fire department ahead of time and warn them.
Yes, correct.
Yep, very important. Yes, you're so right. Preparation is everything. In fact, we recommend that you design the fire breaks into your prairie at the outset before you put the seeds in.
Right, so that you're not doing this stupidly.
Right.
Although the most embarrassing is, and Josh and Neil, you'll both probably appreciate this, the first year we burnt, of course, it was still a baby prairie. Well, we'd read the book, and it said, you know, you call the fire department, and you have water at every corner, and we had all this ready, and we lit it, and nothing happened. And our neighbors had come down to sit in lawn chairs with beer to watch the burn. So, yeah, I know there's also that side of it, the humiliation part. So you also, though, Josh, you've got something, a plant you want us to try to identify over the air. Is that right?
Yes, and I don't know if it's a native plant or not, but I remember seeing it as a child, and I work for utility now, so I'm along ditch lines and stuff, and I seen it again yesterday. It's probably about 6 feet tall, and the distinguishing characteristic on it, it has a pod about 3 or 4 inches long. And I think this time of year they open up, and to me it always looked like cotton or whatever, and there were seeds in it. Any idea what that is?
Well, it sounds like a member of the milkweed family. And it was 6 feet tall. What kind of soil was it growing in, Josh?
Sandy-type soil.
Was it dry, moist?
Moist, very moist.
Okay. That was probably... And the pods were sticking straight up?
Actually, the plant I seen was tipped over, and when I broke the pot off, it was milky.
Were they skinny? Oh, they were milky. Okay.
That's almost certainly the red milkweed or marsh milkweed that we spoke about earlier, which is one of the best plants for monarch butterfly caterpillars. So it's almost for sure that's what that is. There are many different species of milkweed, but not that many that get 6 feet tall and grow in wet areas. So I would bet you 90% that's probably the red milkweed.
So it's actually a good plant if you want to take some seeds from it and try to get it, you know, in a closer to home.
I might do that then. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling, Josh. And next, we're back to goldenrod issues. This is Louie from Wausau. And Louie, your question is, what does control goldenrod?
Yes. Patience? No. I'm sure Neil has a better answer than that.
Well, first of all, let's talk about the whole group of goldenrods. There are nice goldenrods, and there are not so
exactly.
nice goldenrods. So the nice goldenrods are the ones that stay put. They don't have runners.
And they're pretty.
And they're pretty.
And they're behaved,
and
yes.
they play well with others, as it says on their report card. And then there are the ones that do not play well with others. Those are the ones like the Canada goldenrod, tall goldenrod, Missouri goldenrod, grass-leaved goldenrod, et cetera, which form large clumps. How do you control these? They're perennials. They creep by rhizomes. They often form large mats and tend to exclude other vegetation. If you have an area where... let me ask you this, Louis. Is it in an area where you planted something, or is it just...
Yeah, it's in my prairie patch.
Okay. And so you have good plants underneath it and mixed in with it?
Yes, although fewer as the goldenrod encroaches.
Yes.
There's also some thistle in there that... but the thistle is not as bad as the goldenrod.
Okay. How much area are you working with that you have?
Small patch.
Small patch?
A couple hundred square feet, a few hundred square feet, yeah.
Well, I don't know if you were listening earlier when we talked about using the glove of death method, where you stroke the plant with a glove saturated with Roundup, which then translocates down into the roots. And there's a specific process for that. We list that in our catalog as far as step-by-step. And we talked about it earlier on the air, so I don't want to bore people with it a second time. But this is something you can do this time of year. And you can go to our website and get that information as well. But you can do it this time of year and typically get good control. The other choice is to go and cut the goldenrods stem by stem down to the base and apply undiluted, concentrated Roundup drip, drip, drip onto that cut stem. Now, this is only works in the fall, and it gets translocated down into the root. It works in the fall before the frost, before it goes dormant. Okay, and this is the perfect time of year to do that, and that will go down in the root and typically kill the plant. But there, again, there is no magic bullet. Fire won't control it. There really is no easy way to get rid of this stuff. The most important thing is once you see that get into your planting is to jump on it right away and get it out of there.
Does that work for you?
No.
We have tried.
Okay, we're back to patience as a virtue.
Maybe I burned at the wrong time, though. Maybe I'll try it as you suggested.
Well, that won't do much because Canada goldenrod is not controlled by burning. And we've tried different mowing regimes and have not found, and maybe somebody out there has had success with this, but I know other people have tried. It is really a wicked, wicked plant.
So, Louis, you don't want to use herbicides? Is that my guess? Or?
Well, it seems that may be more laborious. I was trying to pull them up.
Well, here's another way you can do it.
Uh-huh.
This is what I do in my prairie.
Yeah.
I have limited Canada goldenrod, which is blown in from the neighbors. And after a rain...
Get rid of the neighbors. No.
That's not an option. After a rain, when the soil is damp, you can go out and take a little narrow trowel, and you can pull up the rhizomes and just kind of get under the rhizome with a trowel and get as much of that rhizome and pull it out of the ground. You'll never get 100% the first time, but you can, pulling after pulling, you will get it down to next to nothing. But that's pretty laborious, but it works. And that's one way to do it without herbicides. The beauty of herbicides is it translocates down in the roots and kills the whole plant.
Yeah.
This method will leave some red roots in there, and you'll have to come back 2-3 more times.
Right.
But that gives you an option then, Louis. I hope
yes.
that works.
Okay, good luck.
Okay, thanks for the call and good luck. Patience is a virtue. You mentioned that you need to do this before the frost, and yet I'm hearing rumors of frost tonight, and especially up north, I know that's already happened. Is it time to stop applying? How do we do this?
It depends on the plant. Canada goldenrod is pretty frost tolerant, so I don't think the light frost that they're expecting tonight, at least in southern Wisconsin, is going to be a factor. And
okay.
The main way to tell is if the plant is still green and actively growing.
Right, if it's
once the leaves
over.
Turn brown, then all bets are off. So, but I think we got it. Well, with this weather tonight, it's going to be light frost, and then the next week is supposed to be warm. So I think you got plenty of time left.
I know. It's just this is my time of year. I have good sleeping weather. Let's go take a nap now. So, or we could talk to Chuck instead. Let's see. Okay, Chuck in Phillips, and he has a question on planting seeds from butterfly plant. Hi, Chuck.
Good morning. Nice show.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have some butterfly plants as well as some lupin that have the seed pods on it, and I want to know how I can get more of them by taking these pods and planting them. Should I plant them in the fall? Should I plant them in the spring? Should I just take the whole pod and mulch it down, or how should I go about this?
Okay. The butterfly plant, butterfly weed, butterfly plant, with the little flyers, right? They have little fluffy flyers.
Well, no, this is sort of a pod that's like pointed and kind of looks like cigar-shaped
okay.
pod.
Okay, yeah, and if you open it up, then you'll see there's this little silky parachutes. What you can do is when those seeds turn brown inside the pod, and you can tell this by just pushing on, there's a little slit down the pod. You push on this little slit, and if it's ripe, it'll open up, and you'll see brown seeds inside. And if so, then you can pick the pod, and you can then, by holding the top of the pod where all the silks are, you can strip the little brown seeds off the silks. As opposed to what I did the first time was take those inside and dry them, and all of a sudden the house was full of silk flying all over the place. Not recommended. So
I bet the cat loved it.
jumping all over. But you can then take those seeds and either put them in the ground this fall, or you can store them in a cool, dry location, such as in a plastic bag in the refrigerator or in an unheated garage. But if you do it in a garage, make sure it's protected from rodents because they sometimes will eat the seeds. So you want to put them in a metal container that's rodent-proof. And then you can plant those in the spring. Butterfly weed comes up in warm soil, so you would not plant it until May of next year, and you should get very good results. The lupine, do you know what kind of lupine it is?
No, it's just a wild lupine that we've had for a year or so, and then we bought some from the garden place in winter.
Okay. So there are many different lupines, but you definitely have the seeds, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, because lupines are pretty tricky to collect because their seed pods explode. I just want to make sure you actually have seeds, because a lot of times people see the pods and they collect them, but there's no seeds in them because they literally explode. So you want to make sure you actually have these white seeds. They look like small beans. And those can be planted in the fall for best results.
Again, letting nature do the cold stratification for you, because it's a harder seed, isn't it, Neil?
Yes, it is. And, okay. And there's some species that just like to be put in the ground in the fall, and others don't really care. Like black-eyed Susan, you can plant that almost any month of the year. You can throw it on the snow and it'll come up, okay? But butterfly weed is one that doesn't really require a tremendous amount of stratification. It typically does well with or without. Purple prairie clover typically does well with or without, as does yellow coneflower, bergamot, a wide variety of others. But some absolutely require the stratification.
Some of them are more picky.
Exactly.
Thanks, Chuck, for that call. Does that does that help?
Well, one more question. Do you plant the whole pod, or do you take the seeds out of the pod of the lupin?
It would behoove you to take the seeds out and then plant them where you want them, because lupins are taprooted and they need to be planted where they're going to live, because they're going to put down roots real fast.
Thanks for that call from Chuck in Phillips, and I can vouch for that. We've moved several prairie plants, and it's not fun. You're listening to Garden Talk. And my guest is Neil DeBole, and from Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We are talking about all sorts of things involving prairies. If you have questions, you can call 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 if you're in Madison. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Shelley Ryan, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Garden Talk, and we're taking calls on questions and comments about prairies. And our expert is Neil DeBole. Again, the numbers are 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, 263-1890. And we've got calls coming in again, Neil. This is an interesting one. This is Carolyn from Madison, and you're concerned. It looks like you're concerned about bleeding hearts spreading. Is that right, Carolyn?
Yes, I had planted one, and they just took over my whole area, the whole, you know, planting area. I dug them out, and I pulled out as many of the roots, large roots that I could find. I'm wondering then if I should spray the area with pre-emergent or something to keep them from coming up next year and then replant in the spring, or how to do that.
Okay, when you say replant in the spring, you're going to plant something else there, I assume, right?
Something else.
Yeah, just wanted to make sure, yeah.
Although
I
like
love bleeding hearts, but they spread so bad.
Yeah, it sounds like they like your spot pretty well. What you can do here is, as you're doing, dig all the plants out, and it sounds like they're reproducing from seed, obviously. then by putting down a pre-emergent, you can stop that process of seed reproduction. And they do typically germinate in the spring. So you want to apply your pre-emergent first thing in the spring so that they don't get a jump on you. So as soon as the ground warms up, put down your pre-emergent in that area. And also, if you're going to put in new plants, make sure and put in your transplants before you put in your pre-emergent herbicide, because if your pre-emergent herbicide comes in contact with your roots, it can stunt the roots and possibly even kill the plant. So put your plants in first and then put down your pre-emergent.
Does that work for you?
Yeah, it does. Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck. Although, you know, you could also have a plant sale, perhaps, and sell the Bleeding Heart, because that's a very popular woodland plant.
It's a beautiful
plant.
Yeah, I wish I had this problem.
Yeah, really. I have two clumps, and they've stayed that way for 20 years.
Typically,
it's
pretty well behaved. Yeah, that's unusual.
Well, okay. Well, and see, somebody else has the problem I do. In fact, that's the problem if you put things in a hurry, and then you go, you know, this would be better over there.
Yeah.
We've moved... It's amazing what we've moved in our prairie and then decided, well, it's a prairie, leave it alone. Because this question coming up is about moving tall grasses, and I don't think that's easy to do, too. This is, it looks like, Nellie from Madison?
Yes.
You want to move your grasses?
Yes. They're taking over this spot, and so I wanted to get rid of some of them, and I thought I'd try and put them someplace else.
Okay. Your grasses actually are among the easier of the prairie plants to move because they don't have deep tap roots. They have fibrous roots. And even though some of the grasses have roots that get 4, 5, 6, 7 feet deep.
They're heavy, too.
Yes, they are. And what you do is you dig the clump up, then you get out the forklift, and but you dig the whole clump up and with a spade, go down about a foot, and that'll get you enough root material. And you want to do it when they're dormant. So you're going to want to wait about another month, because the grasses are still actively growing, and usually about mid-October, after a couple of hard frosts, the warm season prairie grasses will go dormant. That's a safe time to move them. Then, and before I dig them, I don't cut them back before I dig them, because sometimes the dead stems make a good handle when you're wrestling them out of the ground. Okay, and then you remove as much soil as possible, or you can simply cut them up. Okay, when you dig a clump, before you take it out of the hole, take your shovel and just put it right down in the center of that clump, and with a sharp spade, just slice it into quarters or eighths, depending on what size it is, if you want to divide it and get more plants out of it.
And that's not as heavy, too. So if you're doing this by yourself, wrestling with those huge clumps of soil can be a pain.
It really can be. And I've done it, believe me, and it's not fun.
So yeah, I have too.
You're better
and try
off
it muddy.
Oh, I'm glad I work in sand most of the time. So you want to slice that plant up while it's, you know, dig around it all the way, get it loose, uh-huh. and then uh-huh. slice it up and then take out each piece individually so you're not trying to carry out 100 pounds of dirt.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Can you leave them tall? And I don't usually cut them off until after winter.
Oh, yes. That's one of the great things about the prairie grasses is that they're very ornamental over the winter, so you leave them stand.
Oh, yeah. That's their winter interest all year.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it provides good cover for wildlife, birds, et cetera. And also, I let my whole prairie stand up, flowers, grasses, everything, because a lot of your beneficial insects will overwinter as eggs and as chrysalises for butterflies, or in the pupa stage. So it's very important that you leave it stand if your goal is to maintain pollinators, etc. And another important thing we didn't talk about earlier is when you burn, we recommend that you divide your prairie into at least two different management units and burn only one half in any given year, which then leaves the other half for the eggs, pupa, etc. of butterflies.
That's a very good point.
Other insects. Very, very important. And if you burn the whole thing, you can burn up the majority of your overwintering insects. So you want to be really careful about that. And rotate every other year. Burn one half one year, burn one half the other year, or vice versa. You can mow it if you're using mowing instead of burning. Mow one half and leave the other half stand.
Thanks, Neil. And Nellie, I hope that helps. Good luck with moving those grasses. I think the best advice is to cut it into smaller pieces, you know, or do it on a tarp that you can drag across the yard, because, you know, some of those clumps, especially if it's an established piece of grass, I've had some where I've got my arm around it and they're just barely.
It's real work. It's real work.
Yeah.
Yep.
See, that's why I have my husband. And I hope he's listening. Okay. Now, this is an interesting question from Jean in Iron County. And this is about peppermint. Peppermint can be extremely invasive. Gene, you're on. What's your question about it?
Well, I used to have it around the house when I was a kid, and I used to like the smell of that peppermint, that mint. And I was just wondering if I could, you know, replant it or where I could get the seed or how do you plant that? So I used to like the smell of it, you know, that peppermint or that mint.
Peppermint is about as invasive as you can get. I've planted it and had it go under the sidewalk and down the hill. Well, Neil, I assume you'll agree with me on that.
Oh, yeah. It's funny, Gene. I grew up with peppermint growing on the side of my house.
Yeah, my grandparents, too.
Yeah, and, you know, where you just mow the lawn up to it, and that maintains it. So it was, we had it boxed in between the lawn and the house, and it just stayed right there because we kept mowing it. But as far as where to get it, it's commonly available at any good garden center that has a good herb selection.
Yeah, it would be with the herbs.
Yeah, or you could just go online and Google it and see what companies sell it by mail. It's not a native plant, so it's not something that we offer.
Well, you just plant it in the ground. I remember as a kid, we used to have it for years, and
Oh yeah, once you got it,
alongside of the house in the shade, and it just stayed there.
You'll have it for life, Gene.
The best advice, and in fact, if you ever get down to Madison, go to Old Brick Gardens, and you can. I think they still have an example of their mint garden. The smartest thing to do is to take a large plastic pot. You can cut the bottom of it out and then sink that into the ground right up to the brim and then put your mint in that, because then that will contain the roots and keep them from taking over your children.
Yes,
and then you've got to watch around the edges. Sometimes it will lean over anyhow and sneak out and start running down the hill.
Or you can keep the rim of the pot a couple inches above the ground.
Oh, even better, yeah.
So the rhizomes can't crawl out. That really helps. We put it in stainless steel.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, nuclear weapons are recommended. But also, there are many different kinds of mint now, Gene. There's chocolate mint. There's the peppermint. There's apple mint. There's a catalog called Richter's Nursery from Canada. And they're an herb catalog. And they've got, 20, 30 different kinds of mint, including one that they recommend for eating in salads.
Wow.
So, go ahead and plant it, but be very careful and make sure you're restraining it. Does that work, Gene?
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Mint is one of my favorites. I do a lot of Mediterranean cooking, so I like using mint, but I've really had to learn where to put it. And what's nice is it likes my rotten soil, so I put it in the spot where nothing else will grow.
Our herb garden, we grow it in 3 inches of sand.
Yeah.
Over a rock.
Yeah.
And between the sage and the oregano, it's completely occupied.
Yeah, I know. You don't have to do anything.
It's amazing.
So, go ahead and grow mint, folks, but be very, very careful. And don't put it in really nice soil. You'll never see anything else again. Next up, this is from Oconto Falls. This is Audrey. And this is a question about milkweed. Is it a perennial or is it an annual? Go ahead, Audrey.
Well, it's just that I had the milkweed in the garden, and caterpillars loved it. And I watched the caterpillars go from one to a stage to another, and I'm wondering whether I have to plant the red milkweed again or is it a perennial?
Okay, the red milkweed is a perennial.
Okay, good.
But red milkweed is not as long-lived as some of the other milkweeds. Usually individual plants will live about 5 years, and that's the end of their lifespan. However, there's a little trick you can use here, as you can do with many other perennials. About every 3 years, you can dig up the roots, and you can divide them, if you so desire. Or you can just plant new ones, whichever is easiest for you. But you can dig up a clump of red milkweed, and usually after about 3 years, you'll get 4, 5, 6 individual plants that you just kind of tease the roots apart, and anywhere where there's a bud attached to roots, you can just pull those apart and then replant them, and you'll get 4 or 5 extra plants.
Excellent. Thank you.
Good
You're
luck.
Welcome. Thanks for calling. Okay, we're getting a little short on time, but we've got time, I think, for one more question. This is Pat from La Crescent, Minnesota. Welcome, Pat. And your question is about flowering weed. I'm not sure what are you talking about? What's the question, Pat?
Well, in years gone by at a construction site, I picked up chicory and bee balm, the lavender bee balm. And the chicory is a weed. Where do you draw the line? This year, something weird came up at the edge of my compost. It's a huge, dark red weed. It's purpley red, and the texture is like cock's comb. It's huge, just huge. It has a stick-like top. And then little tiny pom-poms all around it. And I don't know what it is, but I'd like to put it. It's so red. I'd like to put it with some of the other stuff I have. And where do you draw the line? Can you put pretty weeds in a wildflower garden, too? Or
Okay, hey. I'm going to cut you off, Pat, just so we can answer the question quickly, because we will be going to a break very quickly.
Weeds are in the eye of the beholder. Okay, a weed is a plant that you don't want. So if you've got a plant that everybody else calls a weed that you like, it's no longer a weed. So the question, of course, is if it's an annual, and it sounds like it is, you can collect the seeds from this and then plant it in an area of open soil where annual seeds typically will germinate. But be careful. Anytime you're playing with weeds, you're playing with fire. But hey, some of them are great. In fact, hey, 30 years ago, all these prairie plants were considered weeds, and now look at them. They're perennials. So
yeah, so it's good. You can also get a test plot and try them there, and then you'll have some idea of how they're going to work before you intermingle them with other things. We will check news from National Public Radio in just a moment, but callers that are on the line, hang on. We'll be back to you, and we will return with more information about prairies, prairie plants, burning, I hope, and we'll take more calls for Neil DeBole. The number is 1-800-642-1234, toll-free from anywhere you're listening. And if you're in Madison, please use 263-1890 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Shelley Ryan, host of The Wisconsin Gardener on Wisconsin Public Television, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 12 o'clock, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shelley Ryan, host of The Wisconsin Gardener on Wisconsin Public Television. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and nice to have you with us on this gorgeous Friday. Coming up on Garden Talk, we'll continue taking questions about prairies and prairie plants. We have two people on hold, in fact, with questions on how to get rid of equisetum, horsetail, and some other concerns about using Roundup. We'll be talking with Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery, as I said, and we'll learn how to attract butterflies to your yard. We've talked a little about that already. I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the wonderful prairie grasses that are coming up as well. So call 1-800-642-1234, toll free, or in Madison, 263-1890. Coming up on Garden Talk after this check of the latest news. Good afternoon. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Shelley Ryan, host of Wisconsin Public Television's Wisconsin Gardener, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today, so I'm thinking radio and talking television, or vice versa. We'll be talking till about 12:30 today, and our guest is Neil DeBole of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, and we're taking questions and calls about prairies, prairie gardening, and gardening with native plants. We'll get right back to the phone and the very patient callers. Let me give the number again. It's 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 in the Madison area, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Neil, it looks like we have a question coming up about Roundup. We were talking about this during the break, so let's talk to Gary. And Gary is in Wanakama, Michigan. Is that correct, Gary?
Onekama.
I wasn't even close. Sorry about that.
That's okay. No one seems to pronounce it right.
Well, I know people that have trouble with Menominee, and I've heard it pronounced Menomini. So, and that's in our own backyard. So what would you like to talk about, Gary?
About the ingredient. I believe it's pronounced
glyphosate.
Glyphosate, yes. I'm referring to a Sierra Club website from Canada, where they've studied it, it looks like pretty thoroughly in Ontario, and they say that the toxicity of glyphosate alone is much less than the toxicity of the commercial glyphosate used by consumers due to the so-called inert ingredients in the commercial formulation. They go into it in depth on all the effects here, but I'll just give you the conclusion. It says glyphosate is constantly lauded as benign. These affirmations are based on studies examining the active ingredient only. In the field, our lawns, our communities, however, a different result has emerged. Glyphosate has caused a host of acute and chronic effects ranging from red blood cell destruction to increased propensity for miscarriages. The effects on wildlife from fish to birds and also non-target species have been observed at doses lower than the application rates suggested. I'd like your comments about that.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay.
Well, I'm not familiar with that study, but can you give us the information on where we can access that so we can learn more, Gary? Are you there?
We seem to have lost Gary. Sorry about that.
Obviously,
we can Google that though if it's through the Sierra Club. And Neil and I were talking during the break that this is, you know, we talk about Roundup rather freely, but it's usually used as a last resort. It's never my first choice.
Yeah, I prefer not to use herbicides if possible. In some cases, they're very difficult weeds that are hard to control, and we will use herbicides. And as Gary pointed out, glyphosate historically has been touted as being lower toxicity than many other herbicides. But I think his point is well taken, is there's a lot of discussion about the breakdown products, and it's not necessarily really fully understood as far as what these breakdown products are or how biologically active they are. So there's a lot of discussion, a lot of disagreement on this. But as with any chemical, with any herbicide, you want to be really careful with it and use it in minimal quantities whenever possible.
But well, and that's why I always like the glove of death, because instead of spraying it into the air randomly where it lands wherever it wants, if you have to use it, you're using it in minute quantities on a very isolated spot in your garden.
Yep.
So, you know, with anything like this, whether it's a fertilizer even, that's why we repeat ourselves, read the label.
Yep, so important. But even the label, you know, if you have breakdown products that are not understood.
Right.
You can use it according to the manufacturer's directions, but if there's something really serious happening out there that we're not aware of or is just being learned about, you can follow the directions all you want, but you can still do environmental damage. So.
Well, and Neil and I both see what we can learn about this and see if we can get back to you with more information. I have another show coming up in November, and we can update people then.
Great.
Okay, we have another caller, which may lead right back to the herbicides. this is Peter in Oshkosh, and he wants to know how to get rid of equisetum, also known as horsetail. Peter, I got to tell you, I killed mine, and I was trying to grow it, so...
Okay, I'm on the line.
Yes, you are. How can we help you?
Okay, I have two kind of tough questions. One is I've got a 3-acre prairie up here in Shawano County. It's bordering a river, and we have a overgrowth of equisetum, and it's spread maybe to 2/3 of the prairie. It's very thick down by the river. And I've been trying to control it by mowing it, hoping that I would stop the spread of spores and allow the prairie grasses, the warm prairie grasses that I've got growing, to outcompete it. That's my first question. Go ahead with that one.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not an expert at equisetum control. It's a very difficult plant to control, and this is a plant that goes back to the age of the dinosaurs. It's been here a long, long time.
It's outlasted everything.
You're talking tens of millions of years here, so it's got a pretty good resume as far as its longevity. I think somebody's developed an herbicide that will kill equisetum, but I'm not an expert on that, so I'm not exactly sure on that. But it's very difficult to control because it creeps underground by runners, as I'm sure you've noticed.
It runs. It doesn't creep.
Oh, yes, depending on the species, but they typically spread underground, and it can be really, really difficult to control. In a tall prairie, what kind of grasses do you have in your prairie, Peter?
Well, we've got the five of the Indian grass, little and big blue stem and switchgrass and prairie drop seed. And
is it causing a competitive problem for you?
Well, actually, some of it grows right up into the middle of the Indian grass. I mean, I get a few plants growing right into the middle of an Indian grass.
They get about 3 feet tall. Yeah. There's many different species of Equisetum. There's about a dozen different species in Wisconsin. And some are taller and some are shorter. I don't know if mowing is going to do you much good. The timing of the mowing is going to be everything. What you don't want to do with warm season grasses is you don't want to mow them in June, July, August, or early September, because that's their busy growing season. And also, anytime you're mowing, you don't want to mow between generally May 1st and July 15th, because that's when grassland birds are nesting, and you can destroy the nests. So if you're going to use mowing management on Equisetum, you're going to have to do some experimentation here, but whatever you do, between May 1st and July 15th, really shouldn't mow because of bird nesting.
Then you're hurting everything else in your yard. Here's a possible place to check some advice. Rotary Gardens in Janesville has had a horrendous problem with Equisetum, and they've been slowly moving it back. It's still right along the water, but they've actually planted a fern and moss garden where it was, so they've got some control of it. You might call down to Rotary Gardens, and the director of horticulture is Mark Dwyer.
Mark Dwyer, Rotary Gardens.
Yeah.
Write that down.
Yeah, because he's a super nice guy, very knowledgeable, and somehow he's at least got it in control, and he might have a few tips for you.
I got a second question.
Okay.
I've got a wet mesic area of the prairie, and unfortunately, we planted sawtooth sunflower and oxeye sunflower, and they have just overwhelmed everything else. And we planted 26 different kinds of forbs from mm-hmm. Prairie Nursery, and the oxeye and the sawtooth just absolutely have overwhelmed everything else.
Yeah,
sawtooth. Should start from scratch, or what do you suggest on that?
A sawtooth, if it likes a spot, it can completely take over. It sounds like the oxeye has done the same. Sawtooth,
plant it with the Equisetum.
Yeah, do you have any Equisetum problems there? The sawtooth, like most of our native sunflowers, does creep by runners, and that's particularly aggressive. The oxeye spreads by seed. So I would say in your situation, if it's completely taken over everything, you probably should start over in there. And don't plant that sawtooth sunflower. I'm sorry we ever offered that. We no longer sell it because we've had so many customer complaints about it. So
yeah, that's exactly. I mean, the we've got a few plants that are competing, but it's basically just taken over. So
yeah.
I tried to mow it and just, but I think I'm going to have to start over.
Yeah, it just jumps right back. It's quite the competitor.
Does that answer your question, Peter? Does that help?
Yep, thank you.
You're welcome. That's kind of like we're talking about the Roundup. We all learn as we go, or we learn as we grow is a better way to put it. And I put things in my garden that I should never have put in. And it's just like that as we learn more about the dangers of Roundup and any other chemical, keep a diary, take notes. And if you plant something that you get nervous about, get rid of it. I speak from experience here. Okay, next up, this should be an easy question, Neil. This is Robbie in Green Lake, and is Robbie?
Yes, it is.
Hi. Hi. She wants to know what to plant under a bur oak tree. Is that correct, Robbie?
That's correct.
Excellent question. I'm assuming the bur oak tree is an individual standing out, so it's all alone?
It is. I planted myself in the middle of a lawn. I like the bur oak, but it is growing, and I'm taking out the lawn around the bur oak, and I'm wondering if there's anything that'll be able to compete with the shade as the tree grows.
Oh, absolutely. There's many, many plants that will grow under oaks. The nice thing about oaks, how big is your tree, first of all?
Probably about 12 feet.
12 feet, 12 feet tall?
Tall,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so right now it's pretty much all sun underneath the tree, is that correct?
Sure, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, at this point, because the tree is so young, you can plant any sun-loving plant that you want, because the bur oak root is a tap root primarily. So anything you plant there, even prairie plants, are not going to compete significantly with your bur oak. And bur oak, interestingly, is the only tree that is known to really be able to invade prairie under a burning regime management. In fact, a very interesting study, I believe John Curtis, who wrote Vegetation of Wisconsin, in one of their studies of prairies of Wisconsin, they found a bur oak grub, a sprout, in a native prairie that had been hayed for 100 years. And before that, it was a native prairie that undoubtedly had been burned by Native Americans. And so they were curious about the age of this sprout that came up every year after haying. It got about 5 feet tall, the bur oak did. And so they dug up the root, and they found this gigantic root, and they cut the root crosswise and counted the rings, and that root was over 400 years old. So this tree had come back year after year after being burned and after being hayed and just kept coming back. So, but as your tree gets larger and starts to cast shade, then you can then install some more shade-loving plants, but that's going to take a while because bur oaks are relatively slow growing. But let's say, for instance, you had a larger bur oak. You have very interesting different conditions where on the south side, you're going to have more light that comes under the tree, and on the north side, it's not going to get as much light because the tree will shade it more. So you want to put a little bit more sun-loving plants on the south side and a little bit more shade-loving plants on the north side. But that won't be for a while until your plant, until your tree gets bigger and really starts to cast some shade.
Right, and we're talking quite a while. So right now, any of your prairie plants... I mean, the whole idea of an oak savanna is just lovely. Just
yeah.
Beautiful.
In fact, in my yard, I have a little prairie garden right around a bur oak tree that's about 20 feet tall. And I put some, it's just starting to cast shade, and I've got some little more shade-tolerant plants like shooting stars, et cetera, under the tree. But even right around the tree, sun-loving plants, and they're doing just fine.
So, Robbie, I hope that helps.
Good luck.
Very, very helpful. Thanks.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks. And, Robbie, I think you'll find that you're just going to enjoy having that little prairie garden under the bur oak. I'm Shelley Ryan, and I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk. And we're getting advice about prairies and gardening with native plants. And we still have time for a few more questions. If you call 1-800-642-1234 or 263-1890 in Madison. And next we go to, this is from in Phillips. And this is Steve. Here's one of my perennial, quote, on, bad pun, my perennial favorite problems, Creeping Charlie. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hey, the first thing I can tell you is Creeping Charlie was brought here on purpose to be used for beer making. So we owe somebody some real punishment. And somewhere in my collection at home, I have the recipe for beer making. So if you get tired of trying to remove it, we can go that way.
Yeah.
And now, Neil, how about something more practical?
Well, that sounds great. Let's make some beer. I never knew there was such a good use for this
yeah,
stuff.
That's why it's in the Mint family. It was brought here on purpose. Can you believe that?
I'll be darned. Oh. So you have Creeping Charlie, and you probably want to get rid of it rather than to encourage
it,
right?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing of it is I've heard it numerous times on different shows with Larry, but I've always ignored it because it didn't really pertain to me. Well, it pertains to me now, and I wish I would have paid attention then.
I'll tell you.
Is it in garden beds, or is it like in the lawn? Or
it's in the lawn.
Oh, it's in the lawn, yeah. Mm-hmm. Creeping Charlie is really, really tough because, once again, it's one of those rhizomatous creeping plants. I get it in my shade garden, and I just go rip it out by hand, but the problem with Creeping Charlie, even in a garden, is I mulch my gardens with about a foot of leaves in the winter. 6 to 12 inches of leaves, and a darn Creeping Charlie will come up right through it.
Yep.
It doesn't smother it. It smothers almost every other weed, but it will not smother the Creeping Charlie. And in a lawn, I'll tell you, it's very difficult to get rid of. And that's why people have Kemlon. You know, I'm not saying that's what you should do. Don't get me wrong. Here we are back to herbicides.
Well, and that's almost the case.
Yeah, I mean, you can't. Mowing doesn't stop it because it creeps very low to the ground, so that doesn't do anything.
But one of the things that I've heard recommended, if you want to try to live with it and avoid herbicides, keep your lawn tall, about 2 inches, 2.5 inches. That won't get rid of it, but it keeps the lawn happier, and the lawn will compete with it better. Otherwise, you're back to some very hardcore herbicides.
Bad news,
it has to be something with, 2,4-D in it.
Broadleaf herbicides, which is a whole other group. Yeah, you want to talk about environmental issues. Those are even more so than glyphosate, probably.
But that's the only thing Extension recommends right now, and then you would use a 2,4-D application either when it's blooming in the spring or after, I think it's a hard frost in the fall. Does that sound right to you, too?
I don't know about that aspect of it, but I can tell you one way that I've been able to control it is with our Nomo Turf Blend, which is a fescue blend. And you talked about leaving your lawn long. We mow this at about 4 inches. And once that Nomo is established, it will shut down most weeds, not all. But I don't have any problems with Creeping Charlie. I don't have any problems with dandelions because, as you point out, that tall lawn makes the lawn stronger and has a better root system, which competes with the weeds better, and it also helps to smother them out. The best way to maintain dandelions is to mow your lawn regularly and closely because those flat leaves on the ground, they say, thank you very much, give me some more sun, get those darn grass leaves out of my way. Same thing with Creeping Charlie. And the Nomo fescue lawn also grows in very shady areas, which is where Creeping Charlie tends to have an advantage. I'm not going to say it's going to completely get rid of it, but in my shady areas where I've got the Nomo, I have really almost no problems with Creeping Charlie. It's in the areas where I have pathways, where I constantly kind of beating the lawn down, that's where the Creeping Charlie gets established, where it's not long and growing 3 to 4 inches tall.
I hope that helps, Steve. Also, I've got a small patch of Neil's no-mow mix in my own yard. If you've ever been deep into the woodland, you get this very, very green, tall, silky grass. That's what a no-mow lawn looks like. I mean, it's more clump than a regular carpet, but it's done the same thing in my yard. The Creeping Charlie everywhere else is very happy. So I hope that helps. Otherwise, you have to make the hard decision, do you use herbicides or not? And again, that's for something like that, you can actually go to Extension and get even better advice than we can give here. Quick mention, if you need advice from Extension or the plant pathologist, you can go to my website, which is wpt.org/garden, and we have a direct link with Extension. So, you know, when in doubt, always check with the experts. We have another call, and this also looks like it's a problem plant. This is Fred in, I can't quite, Watersmeet, Michigan. Did I say that right, Fred?
Well, we're at our cabin right now. So
okay.
We're really from Wisconsin Rapids.
Oh, well, then that counts. And Fred, you have a question. It looks like poison oak.
Well, what it amounts to is I'm a member of Central Wisconsin Chapter of Wild Ones. So I have a 40 that I have about a 3-acre prairie on. But in any event, I bought 15 acres of land this spring that is in alfalfa. So I can't really do anything right now with that, or I'd lose my ag exemption. But anyway, I bought seed to plant this fall along the road right away, and I don't know if I'm being nutty to do something like that, but anyway, I'm going to put in prairie seed and grass along the road right away where they don't mow. The only problem I have is I've got poison ivy or oak in there, and some of the big patches I've killed with Roundup. My question is, should I bother trying to kill it all or just broadcast my prairie seed and grass in there? Or is there a prairie grass that's tall enough that if I plant that, it could possibly shade the poison ivy or oak out? I guess that's my question.
Okay.
We only have a couple minutes left, so we'll try to keep this concise too, okay. Fred. So I'm going to put you on hold, okay?
First of all, it's almost certain that you have poison ivy because poison oak doesn't occur in Wisconsin, but that's a minor detail. It's a vine that creeps along the ground, and we should be fortunate here in Wisconsin. It typically is a vine that only gets about 6 inches tall. You go south into the southern states, like Virginia and places like that, they get vines that get 6 inches in diameter and climb up into trees. So it's a whole other creature. But
and there's kudzu. Let's not even go there.
Yeah, well, it's moving north, marching north. But with regards to the poison ivy, you want to get that out of there before you do anything. In fact, get all of the vegetation, all the weeds, grasses, poison ivy, get everything 100% killed off before you put your seeds in. And poison ivy, it couldn't be more important that you do that, especially if you're going to manage your prairie with burning, because what happens when you burn poison ivy? Oh, boy.
Very dangerous.
You do
very
not
dangerous.
Want to breathe that.
It gets into your lungs. And in fact, this doesn't help you right away, but here's a chance for me to promo the Wisconsin Gardener. One of the topics on my show next May, I know it's far in advance, but we're going to do an entire segment on toxic plants because we've got poison ivy, we've got the poison parsnip, and we're going to talk about these dangers and show you exactly what they look like, too, so that you can ID them in your own yard.
That's great, yeah. But get everything killed off first before you put down your seeds, and be really, really careful with that poison ivy. And if you see it in there, dig it out right away after you put your seed in, because then you can't use herbicides, and make sure that it's gone. And I don't know of any grasses that will completely shade it out. The prairie grasses are very competitive, but
so
I would get that
stuff.
So
is poison ivy.
Yep,
and
I would get
that's
that stuff.
Nasty.
It is nasty stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't try to play with it. And for the callers that are still on hold, if we have trouble getting to all of you, don't forget you can call Prairie Nursery directly at 1-800-476-9453, or you can go to prairienursery.com on the web, and they've got not just Neil, but they've got a whole staff there of people that can help with a lot of these questions about prairies. I want to thank Neil DeBole for joining us today from
thank
Prairie
you.
Nursery. This has been great fun, and it's kind of shocking, Neil and I behaved ourselves.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, it's scary. And thank you to Jim Packard for producing this program, and to Keisha Marbra for on-air production and to Joe Hartke for technical assistance and holding my hand. And thank you all for listening. I've enjoyed filling in for Larry today. I will be back filling in for Larry Mueller on November 16th. And you can also check wpt.org/garden for the next time for my program, The Wisconsin Gardener. I believe the next show, actually the next new show, is November 1st, but don't quote me on that. I'm Shelley Ryan, sitting in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I want to thank you all for listening today.